America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. I know you've heard and you've read a lot about retirement. Books abound, there are magazines devoted to it, and you hear lots of talk about it. But there's only one Ken Deichwald, who along with his wife Maddie, heads the organization AgeWave. Together, they have revolutionized thinking about a period of life becoming longer and more important than ever. In fact, he's here to discuss some brand new research, which defines this period in a much more textured way. A masterful presenter, he'll paint a picture in words, sure to describe the journey many of you are on. He's next on America Trends.
With me on America Trends is Ken Deichwald. He has a PhD, but that's the least of the things that we will talk about. He is a force of nature, ringing the bell to alert people to the value of the wisdom, the buying power, and the ongoing cultural relevance of older Americans. And there has been this incredible life extension, but there's also been great extension as to the value of those of us who are a little bit older. Now, Ken has incredible perspective on all of this. He's done perhaps more research on the subject than anyone I can imagine. He understands the marketing aspect of product development as it relates to older Americans. He's a psychologist. He is really the embodiment of the subject matter that he covers, and he's a remarkable presenter. I hope, Ken, I haven't put too much pressure on you to deliver today, but you always do.
Well, I appreciate the compliments, and I hope that I can live up to what you've just framed. So let's go at it.
All right. Well, you founded years back something called AgeWave. And at the time that you founded this, what was the state of gerontology or the study of those of us who kind of get to an older phase of life?
Well, my wife and I actually started our company AgeWave in 1986, but I became interested in and involved in working with older men and women when I was 24, back in 1974. And I had started a project called the SAGE Project, which was the first preventative health research project for older people in the Americas. And then I became really curious, not only about older people, but about aging. You know, how do you get to be a 40-year-old or a 60-year-old or a 70-year-old? You know, what do you do along the way in order for it to turn out well versus badly? And then I became captivated by the fact that most businesses were so obsessed with young people, they were missing the fact that there was kind of a whole new breed of 50 and 60 and 70-year-olds coming along. And so we started AgeWave with the idea of guiding companies in terms of new products and services that they might develop for this new cohort of longer-lived and more youthful older people. And, you know, I'm very proud to say that over the years I've written 18 books, given talks to about 2.5 million people, and we've had over half the Fortune 500 as clients. So it's been a pretty wild ride.
Yeah, you've done extremely well, and thank you, because those of us who are older, number one, we don't want to be neglected, but we feel oftentimes as if the culture is ramping up and away from us. And I know when we look at the body of information that quadruples every 3 days in terms of what is available to us, it can get away from you. And yet older Americans, those of us, and I'm turning 70 now, feel so vital still. I mean, if you ask me what I really feel, I feel about 35. And I don't want to be relegated to the ash heap. And yet, this is a culture that has venerated youth for such a long period of time.
Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing. It's sort of like a pendulum that swings back and forth. If you think back, and I know this is going to sound crazy, but if you think back, we've all seen a painting of the signing of the Constitution and all those founders. Well, think about, if you remember those paintings that we saw in high school and probably even more recently, they were all wearing white wigs or they had powdered their hair white. Now, why did they do that? Well, back in colonial times, it was believed that young people really didn't amount to much of anything. But older people had wisdom, they had perspective. By the way, they also owned all the property, so if you were a grandchild and you're working on grandpa's farm, you'd want to treat him with respect. They got the best seats in the church. It was also believed, and this is going to sound a little bit strange, I know, but before there was any kind of germ theories of disease or aging, it was believed that if you got to be 60 or 70 or 80 years old, God wanted you to be alive. So there was this kind of halo that came with being an older person that was positive. Then came along the Industrial Revolution and the Roaring Twenties and then modern media and then the boomers after World War II, and we flipped from being an elder-oriented world to a youth-focused world, which, by the way, you know, has got some merits as well. Young people are pretty terrific in all kinds of interesting ways. However, today's population of people over 50, it's only about a third of our population, but it's more than 100 million people. But they control 70% of all the wealth. They represent about half of all the consumer power. And they're more youthful and active, and they've got more emotional intelligence and more wisdom than any group of older people we've ever encountered. And so they should not be disregarded. We should be treated with some respect. And I'll tell you this, you know, I started in the field in my 20s, so I wrote my first sort of 10 books about aging before I turned 65. So I was writing about older people from the point of view of a young guy and was quite dazzled by the fact that more and more Nobel Prize winners were older men and women, that more and more CEOs were becoming older women, more and more politicians, for better or worse, are becoming older people. But then when I passed my own 65th birthday and I started realizing I was the oldest person in the room at a lot of meetings, I began to feel that, oh, I should be embarrassed about my age. I should try to claim that I'm youthful. And I've rejected that. My view is that we ought to be proud of our years, and it's time that we in this country had more respect for all the generations, not just one or the other.
Let me ask you psychologically, because boomers, and we're boomers, we had no use for the generation above us. We used to have that maxim that we trusted no one over 30 years of age. And in this society of ours, we have so many divides in the country. What about generational coming together or divides? We have six generations, I believe, on the planet now in industrialized advanced societies. How are we all getting along? Because I really have great respect for millennials and Gen X. I think they're terrific, and I don't like the fact that a lot of boomers put them down or think that, somehow they are not going to be like us. I think there are great generations coming up after us.
Well, a friend of mine is a gentleman named Mark Friedman who created the Purpose Prize in the organization called Encore.org, and I was recently talking to Mark. And he said that, unfortunately, we've created a modern era of what he called age apartheid. And I had never heard anybody refer to it that way. And the idea of it is that somehow it always was the case throughout all of history that people, young people, old people, they went to church together. They went to synagogue together. They worked beside each other on the farms or in the factories. They congregated in the community centers. But in this modern era, we've kind of patch the world together so that folks generally tend to hang around with people in the same age as them. And there's some good things about that. You know, you got a lot of the same experiences. You might like a lot of the same music. You have some of the same views about what you're worried about in life. But the downside of it is that we miss out on the interconnectivity that can come. You know, I learn a lot when I'm around my kids. They're in their 30s about tech, and I learn who Charlie D'Amelio is, and she is the most popular TikToker with 110 million followers, and I learn what they're worried about in terms of COVID, and I learn about, you know, their hopes for their lives, and I contemplate the fact that my kids may live to 100 or more years because of breakthroughs that are coming. So getting into their world makes me more modern, more current. By the same token, younger people, we've just done, as you know, this massive body of surveys with the Edward Jones Organization. And one of the most extraordinary things that came out of one of our recent studies was that currently 89% of the American population agree that we'd all be better off if older adults, instead of just kind of hiding out in their homes and watching TV or playing golf or going on vacations, 89% of Americans now believe that we'd all be better off if older adults were more engaged, more involved, were sharing more, were mentoring more, were more a part of their lives, because they could use our guidance. You know, they could use a few grown-ups in the room. And so I think we're entering into a time where maybe there's a greater appreciation for the connectivity between the generations and what we can learn from each other and maybe even what we can give to each other. And I would say that boomers, it's a tricky one for us because, if anything, we rebelled against the older generation.
Right, exactly.
And now we're the bunch that the young people are rebelling against. So it's kind of head trippy. It's like, wait a minute, we're the older people now.
Well, I've got to admit, Ken, I have trouble psychologically thinking of myself as old. I think I mentioned to you off microphone that I'm still in an old man's rock band. Here I do a podcast, so I've gone from television and radio, and now I'm doing podcasting. And I love to be active. Now, let me ask you this. My college roommate and I, we both had really successful careers, very different ones. We're both financially all right and generally set until maybe the last couple of months, and we're watching things fritter away. He's chosen a life totally built around family and travel in this phase, and that's fine. That's great. I've chosen to stay close to home and family, but working on the podcast, I wrote a book, I'm in a band, as I said, writing music, more insular things. Am I the norm, or am I the exception, or is he the norm? And how's it going these days? What are we really deciding to do? You talked about us not wanting just a retreat. What are we doing?
You know, I looked recently in Webster's Unabridged Dictionary under the word retirement. And what it says is to disappear. And,
I said that in my book. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I think that our moms and dads or grandparents, when they reached 60 or 65, they were kind of old people. And they pretty well thought they only had a few years to go before their batteries wore out. Today, the average 65-year-old has got a 20-year life expectancy in front of them, assuming no medical breakthroughs. Now, if there are medical breakthroughs, you reach 65, you might have another 30 or 40 years in front of you. Now, how crazy is that?
Mm.
So let me answer your question. And in this study called Longevity and the New Retirement Journey, and by the way, I'm going to tell you for all of your listeners, it's the whole report is available for free. It's easy to find. It's at www.edwardjones.com/newretirement. So I'm not saying that as a pitch. I'm more saying that as there's some interesting insights that may blow your mind in a way. But
yep.
One of the things we tried to figure out is, are there different kinds of experiences people are having in their kind of 60, 65 plus years? And we found that there were four distinct types of experiences. Let me tell you a little bit about each one.
Sure.
First, there was a group that we named the Purposeful Pathfinders. These are people who are kind of done the right thing. They've been saving their money. They're loving their life. They feel like they're in their best years. But they want to try new things. They want to hang out with younger people. They want to give back. They're pretty impressive people. Another group is also doing well. We call them the relaxed traditionalists. They view retirement kind of the way our parents did. It's a vacation. And they feel that they've earned it. And they want to just do what they want to do and not necessarily have to give back or worry about other people. They're enjoying their family, and they're feeling a lot of gratitude. But then there's a third group that we named the challenged yet hopefuls. And by the way, I hope your listeners are imagining which of these groups do I want to be, because in the report we tell you how you can avoid certain ones and become other ones. But the challenged yet hopefuls were pretty interesting people. They've kind of lived for today. And they've had good lives, but now they find themselves nearing or in retirement, and they're panicked because they never saved anything. They're regretful. They're worried that, oh, my goodness, how am I going to live the life I want to live? What if I run out of money? What if I have to go back to work? What if I can't make new friends? So they're they're struggling a bit, and they're feeling that somebody should have given them a wake-up call about saving money decades before. So if any of your listeners are in your 30s and 40s, take heed. But then the fourth group, with 31% of the older adult population, the largest group, we call the regretful strugglers. And they're having a miserable time of it. Now, maybe they were dealt a bad hand. Someone they loved got sick and they had to leave their work to care for them and they ran out of money. But what we saw by reverse engineering this segment, essentially going back and asking them questions about what they did, they never really thought much about how do I make a great life for myself in retirement. They didn't do any preparation financially. If they lost a friend, someone moved away or passed away, they didn't seek out making new friends. They're not happy in this stage of life. They don't feel like the good life in retirement is going to land in front of them. So we've got the purposeful pathfinders, the relaxed traditionalists, the challenged yet hopefuls, and the regretful strugglers. And to your point about your rock band, which I believe is called Boom, Band of Old Men, which is a very cool name, 59% of pre-retirees said that they want to do some working in retirement. And it may not be the same job they used to have, and it may not be for that much money, or it may just be kind of a give-back, volunteer job, but they don't want to just sit around and watch TV. They want to be active and engaged and doing things that turn them on.
Well, I've got to tell you, psychologically, now I stopped full-time everyday employment in 2017, and yet the podcast has kept me busy in all these other activities, but I almost feel guilty. I got to ask you, I'm taking the psychologist part of you right now.
Okay.
I mean, I almost feel guilty because I loved work my whole career. I love my career, so it wasn't a job in a sense. And I really keep needing to do something. And the hardest time of day for me is just I'm working in the morning or taking the dog to the dog park, then working or playing my drums or doing something. And then around, I don't know, maybe 12:30, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. And then I find a lot of activities later in the day, but I almost feel guilty. Is that normal?
I'd say it's neurotic, but it is normal. You shouldn't feel guilty, you know what I mean? It's like, first of all, there are some benefits we get if you're over 65, and I want to pay attention to these. During COVID particularly, we came to appreciate these safety nets. I mean, if you're over 65, you're probably getting some Social Security, and the average payout for an individual is $18,000 a year. So that's not going to make you rich. But if you're 42 and you lost your job, you don't have a safety net like that. Plus, the market value of a Medicare policy is $12,000 a year. So people over 65 find themselves with some safety nets that younger people do not have. And I want to give a shout out here as a psychologist that while those of us who are in the boomer generation or Gen X are trying to figure out how can we enjoy these decades of our lives, we ought to be a little bit mindful that there's a lot of teenagers and people in their 20s that have had the wind knocked out of them during COVID.
Yeah.
You know, will I fall in love? Will I have friends? Will I get a job? Will I be able to move out of my parents' house? You know, who am I? So a little bit of empathy for younger generations. But it is true that, Larry, in a lot of ways, you're doing what more and more people are doing. You know, think about it for a second. The largest grossing rock and roll tours over the last 20 years have been the Rolling Stones. Mm-hmm. Now, Jagger is 78 years old, right?
And yeah, but he needs the work. He hasn't really accumulated. I don't think he's saved enough.
Oh, no. You know what? He loves the game, you know?
Oh, I know.
He's 72, and he loves the game. Oprah's 69, and nobody's telling her she's too old to do what she does. And, you know, we got a president who's lived eight decades. And so what's happening is that more and more we're seeing around, you know, hey, Betty White passed away this last year. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden people thought to themselves, wow, there's a 99-year-old woman who's fun, who's funny, who's beautiful, and who's had one life after another over an entire century. And so a lot of people are now starting to change their internal point of view about you may have your best years in front of you. It's going to take some identity reflection, and it may take, you know, kind of going back to school and reinventing yourself, or it may take the willingness to try something new and different or to make a new friend. But I think we're seeing more and more role models emerge like you, my friend, who are, look what you're doing. I mean, you could be sitting around doing nothing. But instead, you got this podcast, and you're a rock and roller, and I understand you're writing songs, and that's what you're going to see more and more of. I think in some ways you're like a pathfinder, and I feel like I am as well. We're trying
new things,
and we're also trying to dispel the impression of older people as being, you know, kind of living back in the day and not being willing to try new things. I think
absolutely.
We got to do more of that.
I call this era for me casual employment, and I noticed in your report, and it is a great report, called Longevity and the New Journey of Retirement, Edward Jones, Age Wave, the Harris Poll, and you also talked about the four new stages of retirement, and I think that's important because I started, when I did leave full-time employment, with a list of activities that I wanted to undertake. I've even taught other older Americans at the University of Connecticut, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. I've taken classes there as well. But I find myself always doing something different. Like during the pandemic, I wrote a book, and now I've been out doing book talks and having a ball with it.
What is the name of your book?
Called No Dead Air. About my career. But the interesting thing, and now I'm going out to promote it nationally. You mentioned to me off the air about Barney, and there's going to be a new documentary on Peacock that I'm going to be in, and then I'm going to be promoting it nationally. But my point is that I find myself needing to start things, and then they come to an end, and find new things that I can embark on. I'm never really satisfied being as quiet as I should be, I think, at times.
To your credit, you're a creative guy. And, you know, creativity doesn't turn on and off with age. But there's a lot of people that are, you know, I'll give you an example. 20 years ago, I was asked by CNN to do commentary as John Glenn announced he was going to be going back up into space again at 77. And I knew Glenn. I testified beside him in Washington, and he was a tough guy. So I watched his initial interviews so I could form my editorial, and a lot of the young reporters were kind of poking at him, you know, don't you think you're a little old for this? Shouldn't you be puttering around the house? What if you have to go to the potty? And Glenn turned to these reporters, and he said, hey, just because I'll be 77 doesn't mean I still don't have dreams. And I got to tell you, Larry, it really made me think, because I think we, in this, throughout history, is we've largely been young people, been not that many older people. You know, the life expectancy on average was only 47 at the beginning of the 20th century. I think we thought that young people, you're supposed to have dreams when you're young, and then you either fulfill them or you don't, and then you go to the sidelines. What Glenn was saying is that, no, if we're going to live 90, 100-year lives, you need new dreams. You need to be willing to try something you never did. Maybe you want to do something you weren't very good at when you were young, but you like doing it. Mm. Maybe you want to make some new money, be an entrepreneur, or maybe it's a time in your life, I do about half of my work now for pro bono, where I like working on projects and helping not-for-profits, not because I'm going to make money, but because it feels purposeful. Let me give you one example. I gave a talk right before COVID, and the other speaker was Harrison Ford, who spoke before me. You know, he's an environmental activist, and he got up and he talked about, he said, we got to get all the young people in the world planting trees to save the planet, and everybody cheered. And I had a private meeting with him afterward. And, you know, I fawned over him for a second. You know, I loved your movies, blah, 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 Raiders of the Lost Ark. And then I said to him, excuse me, Harrison, but do you know that there's 1 billion people in the world right now over the age of 60, and nobody's tasked them with anything? It was like deer in the headlights. He looked at me and he says, I'd never thought about that. By the way, most of us have never thought about. We've got all these people over 60 in the world, again, 1 billion. And by the way, in 20 years, it's going to be 2 billion. Nobody's asked them to do anything. And so it's not just a matter of doing what makes you feel good. I think we could be mentors. I think we could help young families. I think we could teach financial planning in high schools. I think we could help young people get through hard times at Big Brother and Big Sister, you know, organizations. I think there's more we could be in our later years, more purpose we could have. And I'd like to feel that that's something that the boomers will rise up to. I sure hope we do. Otherwise, we're just going to be seen as a bunch of greedy old people.
That is really so interesting. Let me ask you about the issue of age discrimination, ageism, we call it. I mean, recently, David Gergen, and he was a guest on this podcast recently, and it was an honor to share some time with him. And he talked about the gerontocracy in America, saying we do need to make room for new leaders. After all, the issues that they're really or should be dealing with are issues that are really going to be left to them, like climate change, that we better get right sooner than later. But the point is, they're going to inherit all these issues, and that some of the people who are leading us today should step aside in that sense. How did you react when you heard that?
Well, I've known David for a long time, and you know, he's been advisor, I think, to every president since Lincoln. You know, he's had quite a tenure. By the way, he's one of the wisest beings on the planet, and
yeah,
you know, he's
really
older,
nice,
but
man,
he's a spectacular guy. But I think there's truth in what he's saying, that sometimes power can be held by older people. Let me give you an example, and I'm going to make this too simplistic, but there's a little truth to it. Other than the Obama election, people generally voted their age. About 30% of 30-year-olds voted, about 50% of 50-year-olds vote, and about 70% of 70-year-olds vote. Now, that's a right. So people are free to vote, but we see that a lot of issues in America tilt in the direction of what older people view to be important just because they exercise their right. Now, if they're not also thinking about how do we create benefits and advantages and opportunities for young people, if they're only concerned about what matters to them in their life rather than using their elderhood to think about what matters to future generations, then we got a problem. I also think that whether it's in a company or an organization or a politics, a lot of older people sort of have got a lock on things. And, you know, turn on the news tonight, you're going to see a lot of silver hair. And while I think that that's what happens in a democracy, that's okay. But I think we who are older need to also realize that that can be a real turnoff to young people. And unless they see their issues and people like them, and people who care about them being more vocal, they're going to feel that the country is really not there for them. And that's not a good thing.
Lifestyle patterns. Those of us who are older living in communities with older people versus those who are moving with purpose to a college town or to an urban setting because they want to see more diverse and younger faces. What are you finding in that regard?
You know, when I grew up, Larry, probably you can remember this too, there were three flavors of ice cream, vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry. And if you went to a jazzy restaurant, they'd have a thing called Neapolitan. Now there's like 1,000 ice cream flavors. Same with there were three TV networks and public television. That was it. Now there's more TV networks than I can even imagine. I think there's lots of different flavors of how to live in retirement. My mom and dad lived in a retirement community. They loved it. They felt that the people that were in their community were like them and dressed like them and talked like them and, you know, believed in things like they did. It's about 7% of the American older population choose to live in age-specific communities. A lot of other older people are deciding they want to live near their grandkids. More and more people are deciding they want to live in college towns because there's classes they can sit in on, mm-hmm, and it's interesting. There's always an inflow of young people, and there's coffee shops where there's cool things going on. Frankly, I'm seeing more and more people deciding to live in communes. And I don't mean like, you know, Jimi Hendrix posters on the wall communes. I mean three or four people get together, like Golden Girls back in the 1980s, and say, hey, you know what, it's very expensive to live alone. What if one of us should need some help caregiving or buying groceries for yourself? Is being isolated is not so good. Why don't three or four of us get an apartment or a house together? And I think you're going to see more and more of that. I also am concerned that coming out of COVID, that more and more people are feeling they don't ever want to be isolated. You know, being about 25% of our older population are isolated. They're solo.
Yes.
They don't have a partner, and their children, they may not have children. Or, you know, 20% of the boomers had no kids. And so now in their later years, they're feeling, I want to make sure that I live in a place where I can be more connected, either through the library or the fitness center or the, like you mentioned, Osher Learning Program, but I don't want to be isolated. And by the way, our studies have shown that some of the people who do the worst in their later years are isolated. They do the worst physically. They do the worst in terms of social engagement. Their levels of depression are higher. Not everyone, but generally speaking, being socially connected, having people who you can love and who can love you back is a big benefit. So I guess I want to say it's not for me to say everybody should or should not live in a retirement community, but I would say give some feeling and some thought to how and where you want to live, where you can afford. You may want to downshift. You may want to be around younger people. By the way, you may want to be where there's good public transportation in case you find yourself not wanting to drive so much. And giving some thought to that in advance is probably a good thing.
When we think of retirement, I don't want to keep you much longer. I mean, you are in such demand, and I'm so grateful to have spent this time with you. But we do find that when we hear the term retirement, everybody thinks about the financial component of retirement. That's all we seem to hear. Retirement always comes with that financial package. Now, because we have these regretful strugglers, as your report reminds us, and that is a large segment, we still have to talk about getting prepared financially. But I think we've got to help people get prepared in so many other ways to think, as you say, about another 15, 20, 30 years. And what do you really want from that period? It may be the most exciting time of your life, or it may be, as you say, one of the most isolated and lonely times. So what more do we have to do to remind people that there's more than just making certain that you have a fat 401k as you approach this period?
Boy, that's such a great question, Larry. And, you know, maybe we can continue this in another call because there's so much to talk about. But let me answer you because it's important. One of the most interesting things that came out of our studies this last year, and again, they're all available for free at edwardjones.com/newretirement. We realized that there are four pillars to living well in retirement. Money is only one of them. The other ones are health, family, and purpose. And then we realized that less than a third of the population did much thinking about or preparing for any of those pillars in advance. Now, when my kids, they're now in their 30s, as I mentioned, when they were in high school, contemplating the 4 years of life after high school, man, there were college counselors, there were military recruiters, there were workshops you could take, you could go visit colleges, you could spend a weekend, there were live cams so you could observe what the college felt like in terms of the community centers. Yet when it comes to this 30-year period of life that's emerging, there's no boot camp, there's no summer camp, there's no orientation curriculum. And so most people wander into this new stage of life without much of a clue about what the possibilities are and what the choices are and what other people might be doing. Keep in mind, you mentioned ageism earlier. One of the worst versions of ageism is in modern television. People over 50, as I said, make up about 44% of the adult population, but they're less than 20% of the characters we see on TV. And normally when they're on TV, with respect, they've got dementia or they're the kooky aunt. We're not seeing the positive role models of 60 and 70 and 80-year-olds. So how do you even begin to imagine who you could become? We need to do more of that. The more preparation and foresight that goes into the financial, as well as the purpose, as well as the family, and as well as the health, the more likely our later years are going to turn out pretty great.
Well, it's been great to speak with you. Remarkable man, Ken Dykewald. I can't thank you enough. And again, we want to focus your attention on this lifestyle study, longevity, and the new journey of retirement, examining today's changing definition of retirement. And you can get that, as was indicated, at Edward Jones. What is it? Forward slash.
But if that's wrong, try the backslash. Sorry. Let me say one other thing. And by the way, I don't say this to make money from it. I recently published a book that represents 10 years worth of thinking and studies. Called What Retirees Want, and it's sort of like a guidebook for your retirement years. I'm donating all of my author's earnings to the American Society on Aging, a not-for-profit educational organization. So it's a valuable tool and a valuable resource. I've been getting some great reactions from folks all over the world about the book.
You are a remarkable person at any age, and thank you so much for being with us today. Say hi to your wonderful wife, Maddie. She was a guest earlier on America Trends, and it's really an honor to know both of you. Thank you.
Wait. Before we sign off, though, I have to ask you a question.
Yeah.
So you've been this broadcaster, writer, creative force all your life, and now you're turning your attention to music. Who's your favorite musician from this life?
Well, in this modern era, Brian Wilson, and you're out in California.
Beach boy, Brian Wilson.
Well, the melodies that he has created, the orchestral arrangements, the harmonic brilliance. I've seen him and his band about 25 times. You can close your eyes and you think you're in heaven. I mean, it's just something gorgeous to behold. I don't know. What would you say?
I would have to say that my best concert I ever went to was Prince. My favorite singer is David Ruffin from The Temptations,
and I would have
to say that Jimi Hendrix and maybe Stevie Ray Vaughan are my favorite musicians.
All right. I see you like my little harder edge with the blues there. I love it. Ken Dykewald,
be well.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
You too.
Friend.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.